Hello, chums, and welcome back to Underwood & Flinch Underground. This is episode 38, and so, gazooks! Well, that means that we're just 7 episodes short of the 45-episode total of the original Underwood & Flinch novel. So, I can confidently predict, then, that this story will have more episodes than that. Probably by quite a few. So, there you are. This episode is another Lydia episode, and the reason for that is because her storyline is still a few days behind, you know, in the timeline, a few days behind the other storylines, and so it has a bit of catching up to do. Fortunately, the last Lydia episode, as you know, wasn't that long ago, so you shouldn't have to strain the old grey matter trying to remember what's been going on with her. But for those of you, like me, who can't remember anything, unless it's written down on a sign hanging around your neck, here's a short recap. Lydia and Miguel, as you know, are now vampires. The Bensons aren't, and in the last episode that featured these characters, Miguel killed Monica, the prostitute that they'd kidnapped, and then they left Spain for London after disposing of her body. Gerald and Cynthia were feeling a bit used and ticked off. But, you know, that's essentially all that you need to know before we begin this episode. Oh, and before we start the episode, just a quick accent apology in case I do it horribly wrong. And an explanation for people who are outside the UK and may not be familiar with the accent in question. In this episode, I attempt to reproduce the London accent that academics call MLE, or Multicultural London English. This is apparently known as grime, or road talk. You know, I read that much online. And it's essentially the new Cockney accent, and it's spoken by working-class young people from all ethnic backgrounds throughout London. I don't try to embellish my character dialogue with authentic slang, because most of you wouldn't know what these words meant, and frankly neither would I, so I'd probably use them incorrectly, and young Londoners, should any be listening, would laugh at me, isn't it? Anyway, so that's everything. Time now for me to shut my north and south, to use old Cockney rhyming slang, and raise the curtain once again on Underwood and Flinch, Underground. A novel written and performed for podcast by Mike Bennett. This podcast is intended for an adult audience. Episode 38. Well, here it is, my home from home. From the passenger seat, Lydia pointed ahead to one of the elegant Georgian houses in the terrace to their left. Gerald, Cynthia and Miguel all followed her finger. The houses were 3-storey, 4 if you included the basement levels, and in immaculate condition. They were on Princess Street in the Primrose Hill district of Camden. It was shortly after 1 a.m., and they were driving in the BMW Series 7 saloon Lydia had rented at the airport. She had wanted a 4-wheel drive, but since they hadn't booked in advance, they'd had to settle for something else. She felt the BMW was a good call. Classy, without being ostentatious. A nice family car that wouldn't look out of place in the neighbourhood. Gerald was driving. Lydia had convinced him he should be the first nominated driver, as he'd want to use the car to get around during daylight hours, something she entirely intended him to do, whether he wanted to or not. He now looked left and right, searching for somewhere to park.
Ah, looks like all the parking spaces are taken.
Yes, bloody typical, isn't it? Said Lydia. Never mind. If you drop us here, we can bring in the bags while you find a spot in a neighbouring street. There's always somewhere nearby.
This was a lie. Finding a parking spot at this hour of the night was as easy as finding a needle in a haystack.
Gerald stopped in the road outside the house, and Miguel, who shared the back seat with Cynthia, sat forward, thrusting his face between the two front seats.
"Which house is it?"
Lydia pointed again to the house which was now beside them.
"This one."
"Oh my," said Cynthia. "It's gorgeous."
"Yes, isn't it? Dad bought it for a song in the 70s. He needed a bass for whenever he was over here on business. The sex lawyers sorted it all out. But it is ours, or rather mine. Dad left it to me in his will, after much persistent begging on my part."
"I don't mean to be vulgar," said Cynthia, "but at today's prices, it must be worth an absolute fortune."
"Oh yes, it is."
Lydia opened her door and got out. Cynthia and Miguel did the same, following her round to the rear of the car, where she popped the boot. Cynthia took out her and Gerald's cases, Miguel, his and Lydia's. In the end, Lydia had only brought a few outfits she felt she absolutely had to have. Everything else the Bensons had retrieved for her from her homes, she left in their spare bedroom. She would, she told them, sort it all out when she got back. Gerald and Cynthia had been annoyed, but had said nothing. And as Cynthia looked back to the car from the pavement, she saw from the look on Gerald's face that he was feeling much the same way now.
"See you in a bit, then," he said through the open passenger window.
Cynthia waved and gave him a sympathetic smile.
"We'll put the kettle on, dear."
Gerald wound up the window, but not in time to conceal his harumph as he drove off. After dropping their bags in their rooms and a brief tour of the house, they went to the kitchen, where Cynthia, true to her promise, put the kettle on.
"Oh, not for us, Sin," said Lydia. "We have to go out and hunt."
She directed this remark equally to Miguel, who was just about to remove his coat.
"Really?"
said Cynthia, standing with tea bags poised over cups.
"But you already had Monica. I imagine she must have been quite feeling, since you know, had all of her." "Well, yes, we're fine now, but I'm thinking ahead to breakfast. When we wake up, we won't have fed for 24 hours. We'll be famished."
"I could eat something now," said Miguel.
"Yes, I'm sure you could," said Lydia. "But you need to learn to rein in your appetite and eat tactically."
Miguel shrugged.
"Sure, I can't do this either."
"Good. So, we'll do it now. There'll be fewer witnesses around at this time of night than in the early evening. We can nab someone, bring them back, and have them ready to eat when we wake up."
"Yeah, but you say there will be fewer witnesses. Won't there also be fewer victims?"
"Oh, we'll find a tramp, I'm sure. That's one thing London can always be relied on for."
Miguel grimaced.
"Ugh, a stinking tramp. I was hoping for a sexy whore."
"Well, of course you were, but this is a nice neighbourhood, Miguel. We don't do street walkers, and it's just as well, too. Dining on the grimy, bearded neck of a tramp might remind you to hold back when you're feeding."
Miguel's lip curled in disgust, but he nodded, then grunted,
"Okay."
Just then, the doorbell sounded.
"Ah, that'll be Gerald," said Lydia. She looked at her watch. "And in only 20 minutes. He must have found something nearby."
"Nearby?" said Cynthia.
20 minutes is hardly nearby."
"It is round here when you're trying to find a parking space at night." They all went to the door, and Lydia opened it.
"Phew!" Gerald huffed. "I had to drive round for bloody ages. Not a space to be found anywhere."
"Where did you park?" asked Lydia.
"I don't know. Somewhere on the road by the park. Almost got lost finding my way back again."
"And yet here you are, safe, sound and victorious. Home is the parking space hunter."
"Yes, well, next time you can be the bloody parking space hunter."
He looked to Cynthia.
"Did someone mention tea?"
"Yes, through here. Kettle's just boiled. Though it's just us, darling. These two are off out tramp hunting."
"Oh, delightful. But why? You ate earlier."
"It's for breakfast, Gerald," said Lydia, stepping past him and outside. "Don't wait up."
Gerald found himself momentarily lost for words as Miguel went out to join Lydia on the doorstep. It had only been a few hours earlier that they'd had to dispose of Monica's corpse, and the thought of fresh murder left him cold.
"You
He checked his voice, glancing at the houses around them and dropping it to a whisper.
You won't kill this one, will you? You're going to keep them alive and then let them go. That's what you said.
Of course, said Lydia quietly. The last thing we want to do in a city like London is murder anyone.
Gerald looked at Miguel.
You understand that too, right?
Miguel looked offended.
What? One time I have an accident and now I'm the little kid. Of course I understand.
Oh, all right. Well, I suppose we'll say good night then.
Good night, darlings, said Lydia. Sleep well, and if I need anything tomorrow, I'll leave you a note on the kitchen table.
Then she linked Miguel's arm and led him off in the direction of Primrose Hill.
Yes,
Gerald murmured under his breath, just loud enough for Cynthia to hear.
I'll bet you will.
Primrose Hill, the actual hill as opposed to the surrounding residential district, makes up the northern section of the Regent's Park. By day, the park can be seen as one of wide open green spaces, peppered with occasional trees and crisscrossed by pathways. But at night, it is a lake of darkness. The streetlights along the pathways brighten the routes of nighttime joggers and dog walkers, but everywhere else is pitch black, unless you happen to be a vampire. Lydia and Miguel entered the park with linked arms. To any casual observer, of which there were none, save for those in the infrequent cars that glided past, they might appear as two lovers out for a nighttime stroll. The night was cold, and Lydia huddled close to Miguel.
"Isn't it amazing?" she said. "Look around. You can see everything just as plain as if it were day."
"Yes, and you know what I see?"
"What?"
"Nothing. This is a bad place to hunt, Lydia. We're wasting our time. Let's go to a nightclub. We can pick up a drunk girl."
"Oh, you'd like that, wouldn't you? A real challenge."
"I don't care about the challenge. I want a good time. We can dance, have a few drinks, have some fun picking out a chica borracha, and then boom, we move in, fascinate her, and take her home."
"Yes, we could do that, but there'd be witnesses. Drunk girls tend to travel in packs, as I'm sure you're aware. It's what gives them sense of security enough to get drunk in the first place. On their own, they'd be beating off the likes of you with a shitty stick. The old you, I mean, not the new you. The new you? Well, not even a shitty stick could save them, could it?"
Miguel laughed.
"I know this stick. I've always been good at dodging it. The trick is not to take no for an answer."
"Oh, how charming. You're a regular David Niven, aren't you?"
"Who is this?"
Lydia smiled at his puzzled expression. "Oh, never mind. Just a dead film star. Yes, we can go to a club if we absolutely have to, but I feel the need for a walk. Don't you? We've been cooped up in cars and planes all night. Isn't it lovely just to be out in the fresh air and just feel the night around you?"
She stepped away from him to throw her arms wide and turn around on the spot.
"It's ours, Miguel. We own the night. Once upon a time I would have been nervous walking through a park like this at this hour, worried that there might be some mugger or rapist lying in wait for me. But now, now I relish it. I can think of nothing I'd like more than some wanker to come rushing out at me with a hard-on and a kitchen knife."
She laughed and called,
"Come on, wankers, come and get me."
Miguel, amused but also seeing an opportunity to labour his earlier point, looked around with a searching eye. He shook his head.
"No. No hay nadie, Lydia. The only food in this place is the fucking owls."
He turned back.
"Come on, let's go."
But Lydia stood still, her head cocked towards the path ahead and a look of concentration on her face.
"What?"
said Miguel. She held up a hand.
"Shh!
Listen. Can you hear it?
Miguel listened. Voices. Distant, male voices, carried on the wind that blew in intermittent gusts from the northeast. They were boisterous, probably drunk. He raised his eyebrows.
Maybe it's your wankers, no?
Lydia smiled. The mating cry of the common tosser.
Let's find out.
Jake Bradley was trying to roll a joint by the glow of his friend Brian Barrett's phone. This would have been tricky enough when drunk, stoned, and standing up, but to do so in these windy conditions made it considerably more so. They were sheltering behind a large oak tree, huddled against the trunk and hunched over their work.
"That's it," said Jake, crumbling a pinched lump of heated cannabis resin into the three papers he'd stuck together and held shakily between his finger and thumb.
"I got it! Fuck!" A gust of wind snapped the papers sideways and the contents vanished. Brian burst out laughing, not so much with joy, for he'd wanted the operation to succeed as much as Jake had, but with surprise.
"Shit, man, what a fucking waste!"
"Yeah, it's a fucking waste, and it's not fucking funny either."
"No, I know,"
Brian continued, still laughing.
"It was just, you were like, so careful and so close, and then..."
He blew a raspberry to represent the moment in replay.
"It's gone, isn't it?"
"We should have rolled one before we come out," said a voice from the other side of the tree.
"I told you we should, didn't I?"
This was Kevin Evans, whose 18th birthday was the reason the three were out this late on a Tuesday night.
"No, you didn't," said Jake. "You said roll another one. You didn't say for the fucking journey. You was talking about having that back at Tricky's."
"Yeah, but if you'd rolled it there and we'd left, we'd have it now, wouldn't we?"
"Ah, shut up, man. What are you doing round there anyway? You've been pissing for like half an hour."
"Yeah, and I've still got a bit more."
"No, you ain't. You're just imagining you do. Put your knob away, let's get a move on."
"No, I've got more in there, I know it. I don't want it to come out and piss in my pants."
The thought of Kevin wetting himself set Brian off into another fit of laughter. Jake rolled his eyes, went around the other side of the tree and shoved Kevin in the back. Kevin staggered forwards into the tree trunk and hit his head.
"Ow! Fucking hell, Jake! I could have pissed all over my fingers."
"Yeah, but you didn't, because you ain't pissing, innit?"
Kevin pushed his penis back into his trousers and turned on Jake with his fingers extended like claws.
"How do you know, eh? You want to lick it off, do you?"
He lunged at Jake and for a second was able to rub his fingers and hands over Jake's face before Jake pushed him away.
"Oh, you dirty bastard!" "It's all right, I didn't piss on him,"
Kevin laughed.
"So fucking what, man?"
said Jake, grimacing and wiping his face with his sleeve.
"You've had your filthy cock in your hands, and now you've gone and touched my fucking face."
"What, like you're a stranger to having a filthy cock in your face?"
Kevin laughed.
"You fucking love it, you slag."
"Yeah, Jakey."
Brian joined in Kevin's laughter.
"Just another night in the park for you, innit?"
Outnumbered, Jake surrendered to the funny side of things. He laughed begrudgingly and gave his face a last wipe with his sleeves.
"Yeah, you fucking wish."
After exchanging a few playful punches between them, the three young men continued on their journey home through the park. Official celebrations for Kevin's 18th were planned for the weekend, but to have not gone out on the night itself would have been unthinkable. The three lived in the Chalcotts estate on the north side of the park where they had grown up together. Jake and Brian had left school at 16. Jake to sign up with a recruitment agency and begin a string of 0 hours contracts, including, amongst other things, turns as a road sweeper, a factory hand, and currently as a worker in hospital laundry, which he hated with a passion. Brian had joined his dad's plumbing firm as an apprentice, and Kevin had stayed on in school to do A-levels. If he could get enough good results, he was hoping to study business at Warwick University. None of them had intended to be out quite so late, or to be quite so wrecked, but one thing had led to another, and here they were.
Jake and Brian had arranged to meet a local drug dealer, Tricky, early on into the pub crawl to buy a gram of cocaine as a surprise birthday present for Kevin, but Tricky had texted them throughout the course of the night, repeatedly putting the meeting back until ultimately asking them to come to his girlfriend Dervla's flat on the southeast side of Primrose Hill Park. This had resulted in the whole gram of coke being snorted there by everyone, including Tricky and Dervla. But none of the three young men had minded, especially since Dervla, whose rich parents indulged and financed her aspiring modelling career, had plenty of beers in the fridge. But when their cocaine had run out, so had their welcome.
"You guys want to come back to mine for a last smoke?" said Jake. "My old dear will be out for the count, so as long as we keep it down, we'll be good."
"No, man," said Brian. "I got to get up in the morning."
Picturing the awful reality of that in his mind made him laugh.
"Fuck knows how, man. I'm done for the night. Ain't you? Shit, man, you got to get up even earlier than me."
"Oh, fuck that. I ain't going in. I fucking hate that place."
"What, you gonna pull a sickie?" asked Kevin.
"Nah, I'm gonna tell them to stick up their fucking asses, innit? Fucking shithole. I can't get the stink of that cleaning shit out of my nose for hours after work. I can even smell it now just thinking about it."
"What's it smell like?" asked Brian.
"Your mother's pussy, innit?"
Jake laughed and raised an arm to ward off a slap from Brian.
"What? You know what that smells like, man. You're down there every night."
That earned him a volley of blows, which he fended off, laughing, as were they all. Then Kevin said,
"Whoa, guys, check it out."
He pointed ahead to a bench beneath a streetlight, and the dark shape stretched out along it.
"Looks like a homeless."
Jake reacted with disgust.
"Ah, oh, fuck, man, I hate them fucking homeless. Always fucking begging and shit."
"It's not a lifestyle choice," said Kevin. "Could happen to anyone. Could happen to you, even."
"Bollocks, could it? I work for a living, man."
"Yeah, except when you don't feel like it," said Brian.
"Come on, let's get a look at him."
Jake led them over to the bench. Kevin was right. It was a person bundled up in a sleeping bag. Beneath the sleeper was a large, flattened-out cardboard box of the size that might have once contained a washing machine or similarly sized object. The cardboard extended up onto the back of the bench to afford some shelter from the wind, and the sleeper, whose head was cocooned within the sleeping bag, lay with their face towards it. Jake turned to the others with a grin and raised a finger to his lips in a hush gesture. Then he pulled down the front of his tracksuit bottoms and took out his penis. He nodded at Brian and Kevin to do the same. Brian looked puzzled, so Jake moved his hips in a side-to-side motion to indicate his intention. Brian stifled a laugh and took out his penis, but Kevin didn't. Jake frowned at him.
"I've just been," Kevin whispered.
Jake gave him a sour look and whispered sharply,
"You said you had some more, remember? So?"
He nodded at the sleeper.
"Now you can get rid."
Kevin sighed. Without enthusiasm, he took out his penis. He disliked peeing alongside other people at the best of times. He stared straight ahead and tried to think of a running tap. Then he heard the sound of water splashing onto fabric. A second stream followed, adding to the spattering. Then first Jake, then Brian, burst into laughter. Kevin looked down to see the sleeping bag stirring into life. It was dark and glistening with urine. Jake and Brian had sprayed liberally and wide, the liquid running in rivulets from the now wet cardboard beneath the sleeper. Kevin hurriedly put his penis back into his jeans and zipped up. Then came the sound of muffled barking. There was a dog in the bag with the sleeper, and now both were awake. The sleeper was unzipping the bag, and through the sound of barking came a woman's voice.
"What the fuck?
Whoa, it's a fucking bird, man," laughed Brian.
As she rolled onto her back and the bag started to open, Jake, laughing, pissed straight into the opening and the face inside. The woman screamed, and her hands went to her face. then a small dog, a wire-haired mongrel terrier, wriggled free from the bag, barking furiously. Even though the animal was far from intimidating, both Jake and Brian jumped back and instinctively covered their exposed genitals. Jake cursed as his own urine splashed down onto his tracksuit bottoms. The dog stood on the woman, guarding her and barking relentlessly at the attackers.
Let's go, all right?
Said Kevin. He took a few steps away, hoping the others would follow, but they didn't.
You fucking wankers!
Shouted the woman. She was in her early 20s, and from beneath her woolly hat, blonde hair, wet with urine, framed an attractive, albeit hostile, face. She sat up and gathered the dog to her as it continued to bark.
Fuck off! Easy now, girl, said Jake. You're pretty fit for a homeless. You like this?
He glanced down at his penis and began to stroke himself back and forth.
You suck me off and I'll give you a quid for a cup of tea. Now fuck off, man,
said Brian, now also arousing himself.
Do me, I'll give you 2 quid. Fuck off!
The woman screamed, clinging to the furious little dog as it struggled to break free.
Just fuck off!
Then, from their right, came another woman's voice. My, what a fine display of manhood. Jake, Brian and Kevin turned to see Lydia step into the pool of light. She was looking at Jake and Brian's penises appraisingly. If she won't, I will. Jake, who was discovering the difficulty of maintaining an erection when feeling strangely threatened, was unsure how to react.
What?
You heard me. 2 fine, plump willies for, what was it? £3? Sounds like a bargain to me.
Brian laughed.
You serious, girl? You want some of this?
Some of it? Oh, no. I want all of it.
Jake and Brian turned to each other and grinned. That was when a second voice, that of a Spanish man, came from behind them.
Oh, no, no, no. We share them between us. 1 each.
They turned and at first saw no one. Miguel stood beyond the glow of the streetlight, his black clothes blending with the night. Then, as he walked closer, they saw his eyes, strangely bright, like an animal's. He stepped into the light and stopped, a smile on his face, totally unafraid. He pointed to Kevin.
And this guy? Who gets his dick?
Perhaps we can share him, said Lydia.
Jake and Brian took a step back, both of them trying to correct their clothing and get their penises back to safety. Which in Jake's case was tricky, since he'd let his tracksuit bottoms fall to his ankles. He reached to pull them up as he retreated from Miguel, staggered, and fell backwards, landing on his backside. He howled in pain, swearing and cursing as he struggled with his tracksuit bottoms. Brian and Kevin went to him. Brian reached out a hand to help, but Jake swatted it angrily away. Then, on getting his clothing in order, he got to his feet.
You two are fucking freaks, he shouted. Pair of fucking emo pervs.
How dare you, said Lydia, feigning affront. I'm not an emo.
Then to Miguel,
what is an emo anyway?
Miguel shrugged.
Come on, guys, let's go,
said Kevin, and without waiting for an answer, he started walking down the hill. Jake puffed out his chest to Miguel, nostrils flared and fists clenched at his sides.
What you looking at, you emo bender?
Miguel's eyes flicked to Lydia. She gave a single shake of her head. Brian put a hand to Jake's back.
Leave it, bruv. That ain't worth it.
Yeah.
Jake spat on the ground a short way ahead of Miguel's feet, then nodded, glad to be given permission to back off.
Fucking right they ain't.
He pulled up the hood of his hoodie, then turned, walking away with Brian in the pimp roll style he favoured when trying to make an impression.
Oh no,
Lydia pouted after them as they strutted away.
And I thought we were going to have such fun together.
Maybe next time don't bring your boyfriend,
Brian called back over his shoulder. Jake laughed, then, feeling bolder now they were further away, added,
Fucking emo, bitch!
Miguel joined Lydia to watch them go. Jake and Brian caught up with Kevin, laughing, shoving one another, performing complicated handshakes, and generally reasserting their indomitable manhood to one another. Too messy, Lydia whispered. Miguel nodded.
Si.
They turned to where the young woman was now getting out of her sleeping bag.
Shit! I can't sleep in that. Even my fucking cardboard soaked.
Her voice was strained and she was close to tears. She pulled the wet cardboard from the bench, throwing it aside in despair and revealing a rucksack beneath the bench. Lydia saw that urine had pooled against it.
God, I am sorry, said Lydia, but at least they didn't hurt you.
Yeah, thanks to you.
Are your clothes wet?
Yeah.
The woman felt around the neck of her grubby anorak and the sweater she wore beneath it.
And they stink too. Fucking bastards.
She slumped down onto the bench, elbows on her knees, and buried her face in her hands to hide her tears.
What am I going to do? What am I going to do?
Her dog came to her. He put his front paws on her legs and raised himself to lick and nuzzle at her hands. She picked him up and hugged him to her.
Look,
said Lydia, trying to sound as if she had come to a considered and perhaps foolishly compassionate decision.
You can't stay out here like this. Why don't you come home with us? You can have a hot shower, and we've a spare room you can use.
The woman stopped crying and looked at them, her eyes wary.
I don't want any of that, what you were saying to them, you know, sex and stuff. Oh my God, no. We only said those things to intimidate them. We're not like that. We were just out for a walk and we heard your cries. Well, after that, we couldn't just walk away, could we?
A lot of people would have.
Yes, well, thankfully, we're not them.
Lydia smiled. And as the woman looked up to meet her eyes, the thought of fascinating her crossed her mind. But instinctively, she felt there would be no need, at least not yet.
What about Charlie?
The woman raised the dog's head to her face and he licked at her tears.
I can't go nowhere without Charlie. Oh, don't worry. Charlie can come too.
Lydia said this with a touch of anxiety. She had no idea how dogs might react to vampires. In movies, they always growled and snarled, their hackles bristling as if they instinctively understood they were dealing with supernatural creatures. But so far, Charlie had seemed entirely oblivious to them. Maybe that would change if she came closer. If it did, it would be better to find out now. With the sensible caution most people would display on approaching an unfamiliar dog, Lydia came over and reached out a hand to Charlie's head.
It's all right, said the woman. He don't bite.
Lydia patted his head once and drew her hand back. Charlie barely noticed. He was too busy lapping pee from his mistress's face. Lydia smiled and gave his head a few more strokes, then scratched him behind the ear.
Oh, he's such a cutie. We haven't got any dog food, but I'm sure we can find something for him.
She looked at Miguel.
Can't we, Miguel?
Miguel, who was more of a cat person, managed to conceal his displeasure at the thought of a stinking dog in the house by turning his grimace into a beaming smile.
Sure, we have plenty to eat. Maybe you are hungry too, Miss... What is your name?
Alice. And, yeah, I am.
To Lydia, she said,
Are you sure? I don't want to be a burden or nothing.
Oh, don't be silly, Alice. We have a big house. There's plenty of room for one more. Lydia turned to Miguel and pointed at the rucksack under the bench.
Miguel, why don't you give Alice a hand with her rucksack and sleeping bag?
Miguel looked at the wet sleeping bag. his face a picture of disgust.
"Oh, for God's sake," said Lydia. "It's only piss. It doesn't burn."
Seeing Miguel's face, Alice said,
"It's all right. I can carry it."
She put Charlie down and picked up a sleeping bag. Lydia shot Miguel a scolding look, then said to Alice,
"Oh, don't mind him. He's like that when I ask him to do anything. He'd love to help, wouldn't you, Miguel?"
"Yes, of course," said Miguel, forcing a smile.
"No, so I've got it."
Avoiding their eyes, Alice rolled up her sleeping bag. Miguel came forward to assist.
"Please, let me help you."
"No."
Alice held the sleeping bag away from him, as if he were trying to steal it.
"She is proud," thought Miguel, "or maybe ashamed of it. Either way, better she carry it than me."
He pointed to the rucksack.
"Well, at least let me carry your bag. Please, Alice, it would be my pleasure."
"Your pleasure? To carry a pissy old rucksack?"
"Si, a pleasure and an honour to help you, senorita."
Despite everything, Alice found herself charmed. She smiled.
"All right, then. Thanks."
She took a key from her pocket and, kneeling, unlocked the bicycle lock that was passed through the straps of the rucksack and looped around the rear leg of the bench.
"Why have you got it locked like that?"
asked Lydia, genuinely puzzled.
"Do other homeless people try to steal it?"
"More like them wankers you just seen off," said Alice. "People like that would nick it just for a laugh, empty everything out into the street or the canal."
"Oh, how awful. Well, at least you won't have to worry about that anymore."
Alice stopped in drawing out her rucksack and looked at Lydia, frowning.
"What do you mean, anymore?"
Lydia realised her faux pas and added hastily,
"I mean your bag. It'll be safe. Or at least it will tonight. Obviously after that. Well, let's not worry about that now. Let's get you home and cleaned up, shall we?"
Alice hesitated. She looked from Lydia to Miguel, evidently still unsure whether or not she could trust them. But then the northeast wind rose again, whipping across the open parkland and seeping into her wet clothes to bite her flesh with teeth of ice. That decided her. She held out the rucksack to Miguel.
"Thanks. I really appreciate it. What are your names? I know you're Miguel, but who are you?"
"I'm Lydia."
"Lydia. Okay. Well, nice to meet you both. Do you live far?"
"Oh, no, not far. We could be home in no time."
Lydia held out a hand, beckoning Alice to join her. Alice picked up her sleeping bag, then called to Charlie to come. On joining Lydia, they started down the hill, the little dog scampering ahead of them, sniffing in the grass and clearly happy to be going somewhere, while Miguel trailed about 10 feet behind them, holding the rucksack at arm's length away from his body, as if it were oozing something fatally contagious. I do love a good Samaritan, don't you, listeners? Such a shame that there aren't any around to rescue poor Alice. Join me next time, my friends, for episode 39 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. The music you're listening to is Ahmad Armor by Farid Farjad, available to download from iTunes or Amazon and to stream from Spotify. It comes courtesy of Taranay Records and our good friend Fawaz Al-Malud. And so there it was, patrons. Now, I'll bet you were rooting for at least one of those young men to end up on the menu, weren't you? I know, it would have been fitting, perhaps, but at the end of the day, it's not up to me. Lydia and Miguel make their own choices, and I am only the messenger who relays those choices to you, direct from the Underwood and Flinch dimension. Oh, and talking of other story dimensions, I've started work on After the Plague 2. This one I'm going to write to its completion, and then edit it, and then start releasing it, you know, like a normal author would. So it won't be here anytime soon,
But, you know, I just wanted to let you know that I'm working on it. This is all happening as a result of the very good response I got after releasing the original After the Plague podcast into my public podcast feed. Do you know the likes? You know, the likes on the After the Plague Facebook page went up by over 100 this week.
Oh, how lovely.
I say.
Yes, I know. It's impressive, isn't it? And, well, maybe you were one of the Facebook users that made that happen. And if you were, then thank you, you awesome thing, you. And if you weren't, well, then, you know, maybe because you didn't know there was an After the Plague Facebook page. A lot of people commented that they didn't. Well, now you do. Just jump onto your Facebook, assuming that you still have one, seek it out, and like that sucker. Hmm? Yes. Anyway, I'll be back in your ears again next week with the fourth episode of my 90s TV sitcom set in a music venue, Glitterballs. Why? Because people have been asking for it. Yay! Oh, that makes me happy. In this episode, there will be a visit from an old enemy of Tom's, an inspector from the local council who likes nothing more than to shut down music venues. Will she shut down Glitterballs? Well, you'll just have to tune in next week to find out. So, until then, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening, and thanks, as always, for your support and patronage. You is like proper awesome, innit? I'm so peng. Oh, no, that means pretty. Oh, dear. Never mind. until the next time, farewell.
MikeBennettAuthor.com